Hi, I'm Tim Davies from Fast Hit Performance, and you're listening to Extended.
This is XTP Media.
Instantaneously, the aircraft, you know, we get hit. I get hit immediately. You can hear the sound. The aircraft pitches over, and we're already pretty low. So it pitches over and starts diving. I'm assuming that my right seater is dead, and he's the guy that's actually flying the aircraft at the time.
Welcome to the latest episode of Extended. Welcome to the latest episode of Extended, the ETOPS Aviation Podcast. And we're ready for takeoff.
Hello there, I'm Peter Johnson, and welcome to episode 112 of Aerospace Radio Station Extended. Today, I'm joined by Tim Robinson, and Tim, of course, is Editor-in-Chief of Aerospace Magazine. Tim, how are you today?
Very good, thanks. Hello, everybody.
And our guest today is Brian Harris. Brian is a 22-year veteran of the U.S. Army. He's an officer and a warrant officer, but he spent 5 years as an armor and cavalry officer as well, as an M1 tank and a 120mm mortar platoon leader. So has a fascinating insight in the world of aviation. But more importantly, he's got over 2,200 hours in the OH-58D Kiowa and also time in the AH-64D and E Apaches. So fascinating guest. Brian, welcome to Extended.
Hi, guys. Thanks for having me.
It's a real pleasure to have you on board. Now, just start and put some of that I just mentioned there into context. Brian, you're still with the Army or just about to leave the Army?
Yep, I'm still in. I'm getting ready to retire. In fact, I just turned in my draft paperwork a couple days ago. So, yeah, here in the next year, I'll be a civilian, but I am currently still in the Army.
Right. OK. And what's your leaving rank?
I'll be a major.
Right. OK. So I don't need to call you sir, though.
No, not at all. Not at all.
Only joking. Well, let's talk about your career, because it is fascinating. And I hinted there at some of the things that you've done in your career. But where did the aviation bug start with you?
You know, I think like most kids in the 80s, you know, you had Top Gun, you had Iron Eagle. You know, so you had these movies that were at this formative part of your childhood. And then, of course, the golden age of flight simulators of, you know, coming of age there in the 90s. So I think throughout childhood, I've always been fascinated with it. I grew up right outside of a major Air Force base, MacDill Air Force Base in Tampa, Florida, where they had a ton of F-16s and, you know, go to the air shows and all that good stuff. And then at a fairly early age, I want to say, gosh, probably 11 or 12, I think, I joined something called the Civil Air Patrol, which is like a kind of like a Boy Scouts type thing, but it's affiliated with the Air Force and, you know, has uniforms and drill and march around and stuff and all the structure. And you learn about aviation. And there was even a component where, you know, you could go fly in a Cessna. So, you know, I was 13 or 14 and I'd go on a couple of flights in a Cessna and just fly around. So I've always had a little bit of the bug.
And does it run in the family at all?
No, not at all. My if nothing else, I should have been a sailor. So my
okay.
Yeah, my dad was a merchant marine. And his dad was actually in the Army in World War II. He was a Sherman gunner. But when he got out, it, you know, he did a number of other things, but he, I remember growing up, he had a old shrimp ring trawler. So he and my dad and other guys would go out into the Gulf of Mexico and go shrimping and stuff. So, but yeah, I they didn't really take the airplanes and I didn't really take the boats. So.
So I suppose the question is going to come, and I'm sure it's in the story somewhere, and that's how you get into helicopters. But how did you first join the military? What was the link into the army there?
Sure. Honestly, I kind of going back to the whole, you know, Top Gun, Iron Eagle stuff. I'd always wanted to be in the military in some component. I wanted to fly. Truth be told, I really didn't study hard in high school. And so when it came time to go to college, to university, you know, I didn't really have good grades. And I was struggling to get into a school. And, you know, at the time, the belief system was if you didn't go to a service academy, you're not going to fly, you know, fighters, which is, you know, what I wanted to do. And so I was kind of struggling and trying to figure out what I was going to do. And I got this offer to come to this military school, in Georgia. And it was a 2-year program, and it was for the Army. And up until then, I hadn't really put too much thought into the Army, maybe a little bit. But at the time, it kind of felt like I didn't have any other lily pads to jump to. So I went to this school, and I just bought in on that. And I was like, okay, well, I guess I'm going to do Army stuff. And so that's kind of how that happened.
Right. Okay. So take us through that the first stages of your Army career. And did you then move into the cavalry direct from your training?
Yeah, so mine's a very unique story when taking the width and breadth of most people that join the Army. So again, going to this junior college, you know, we commissioned and we still had 2 years left to finish college. So you were, you know, I was 19 years old when I pinned on second lieutenant rank, which typically you're, you know, 21, 22, something like that. So I'm still have 2 years of school to finish. And at that time I had decided that I wanted to be in tanks. So when you go back to finish those 2 years of college, you had the option to join what we have here in the States is the National Guard, which is a state run military organization that kind of augments the federal government and military.
Yeah.
I was eventually going back to school in Florida. Florida was a complete light infantry brigade at the time. All they had is trucks and, you know, boots. I didn't want that. So I found a unit in South Carolina that was a cavalry organization. And so it was a heavy cav, so it had tanks and M2 and 3 Bradleys. So basically I got in touch with them and said, hey, I'm getting ready to commission. I'm looking for a job in the Guard. And I drove over there a couple hours and had an interview with the commander. And, you know, again, I'm 19 years old and says, okay, well, do you want to be a tank platoon leader? Like, yeah, absolutely. Sure. That sounds great. You know, so, so that's how that happened. And then basically I just was in the Guard for the next two and a half years while I finished up college and, was a tank platoon leader in the cavalry. And then, once I completed college, got brought on to active duty for the regular Army.
Wow. That's quite unusual. And what sort of challenges did you have, Brian, that you, I suppose, taken for your career in being such a youngster in charge of not only that heavy equipment, that complex equipment, that life-threatening equipment, those hard-nosed soldiers as well?
Yeah, soldiers or something else. And you're right about the equipment. I mean, a tank, it doesn't care. It's designed to kill. It doesn't care who it is, right? So, I mean, you could get hurt very easily in and around a tank as a crew member. But I, you know, funny enough, I think that's what got me into aviation because I did start very early. And so, you know, the promotion train is what it is, right? So it, wherever it starts, it there's a sequence to it and it doesn't really matter what your age is. They don't adjust that. So when I came on active duty, I was already a first lieutenant. I completed a year in Korea as a mortar platoon leader. And then I came to Fort Knox, Kentucky, waiting to go to the what we called at the time what was it called? Gosh, it's not called the captain's course. Anyway, it's essentially where captains go learn how to be captains. But I was not ready. They weren't ready to put me in school yet. So they gave me a company command. So I was a headquarters company commander. I was 23 years old when I took over this command of a brigade headquarters that had 150 soldiers in it. And to kind of your point, like I was dealing with a lot of stuff that a 23-year-old me didn't want to deal with, right? It's not what I joined the Army to do. And that's what's funny about the military, particularly I think the Army, is when you go through, you know, ROTC or the service academies and stuff, you know, they spend a lot of time talking about combat and leadership, and you kind of get this impression that you're going to be a platoon leader for 10 years and you're going to be, you know, doing the frontline stuff. And the reality is you're going to do like 18 months. And then you're going to move on to a staff job, and then you're going to move on to a command. You're going to kind of bounce back and forth. Well, at this point, I'd kind of come to that realization that I'm 23 and it's not looking good for me to do fun stuff in the next few years. And so that, you know, because that's leading to your next question, I'm sure, is, well, how'd you get into aviation? And that's exactly what happened. So right. I was having this sort of crisis of faith. I was looking at getting out because I wasn't having fun anymore. And, you know, the war had just kicked off. This was 2003 timeframe. And I wanted to do something, you know, I wanted to do something my age essentially. And I just, by chance, which is very strange because Fort Knox is not a place where they had a lot of aircraft, I happened to meet an Apache pilot. I happened to meet a retired Cobra pilot, and I got to talking to them and knowing them. And they kind of said, well, you know, why don't you transfer over to aviation? And to basically make a long story short, that's exactly what I did. I took a demotion. So I went from captain to warrant officer one, which is about seven or so ranks different.
Wow. Wow.
Just so that I could get into aviation, because Army aviation is weird. It's got warrant officers and commissioned officers that both fly. Warrant officers do most of the flying. Commissioned officers do flying and also the leadership management role. But that was the only way I could get my foot in the door. So that's what I did, and that's how I got into aviation.
Was it? Wow. It sounds like you were. I mean, would it be fair to say then you weren't supported in your in that move to Army aviation? I mean, were all the tank guys trying to talk you out of it and say, you know, you're wasting your time here. You want to be safe in a nice solid tank with, you know, 70 millimeters of armor and all the rest of it.
Well, honestly, that conversation never happened in that regards. Pretty much everybody was, I mean, everyone in my chain of command, everyone who needed to sign the paperwork was very supportive. And of course, going into that, you are very nervous. You know, I'm 23 and I'm going up to this, you know, full bird colonel who's made his career out of an armor officer. And I'm telling him, hey, I don't want to live your life. You know, that's basically what you're doing. but I remember he was a very, very great guy, Jack Ballantyne. And he just smiled and says, hey, I'm, you know, that's awesome that that's what you want to do. So very supportive. Only one guy who I ran into years and years later. You know, he kind of like, oh, don't do it. You know, you're making a bad career move, you know, but based on what, you know, it worked out. It's what I wanted to do. Cause I think at the end of the day, that's what you got to do, right? You got to look back and say, I did the things that I wanted to do and enjoyed, because those are the things you're going to do well versus yeah. I'm doing what the party line says I'm supposed to do. I don't really enjoy it, but this is what these are the widgets that I'm supposed to do. And I didn't want to do that.
That's a really, really interesting way of looking at things. And I wish I'd have had that wisdom back when I was that age, if I'm honest. Yeah. So kudos to you for making that move. Yeah. And how tricky was it? I mean, you know, the system migrated you over, but in effect, you were going into a whole new environment, a whole new setup. You know, whilst I love aviation and flying, starting from scratch again would fill me with all sorts of worries.
Sure. You know, it actually wasn't very hard. I contacted the what we call the personnel, the human resources command, or, you know, they run all the personnel movements. And basically they just said, look, you know, you need this form, it needs to be filled out by your colonel, and you need a good flight physical, and you need a good what was called at the time a flight aptitude skills test, I think, something like that. I can't remember the name of it. So that was the only, you know, quote unquote challenge, is having to take that test, which, you know, I had kind of grown up doing, you know, I hate to say flight simulators, but you do get an appreciation of things. If you kind of play flight simulation, you understand the basics of aerodynamics. I was studying helicopters because I didn't know crap about helicopters. So I was studying anything I could about how the rotor worked and, you know, all these different things. And then I had to take the physical, which was kind of its own little adventure, because they said I was too tall. And I basically compressed myself in my seat and asked them to measure me again, because I was one centimeter too tall. They said I was 102 centimeters. And, you know, and I'd never heard this. You know, he was like, well, you're disqualified. I was like, what do you mean? He said, well, you're 102 centimeters. You need to be 101. And I just, you know, squeezed out of my seat and I said, can you measure me again? And they measure me again. He's like, oh, okay, you're 101. Okay. So that was the only real challenge. And then it was just, you know, like I said, getting signatures, which everyone was supportive of. And then it was the adventure of, you know, moving to the, from Fort Knox to Fort Rucker, Alabama, walking into a building as a captain, walking out of that same building as a W-1, and then figuring out where I was supposed to go next. You know, and I just went down to the flight school and reported in, and they were looking at me funny, like, who is this guy? You know, cause normally you come from what was called the warrant officer candidate school. And that's where guys were being pinned on as warrant officers. I didn't go through that route. You know, they basically just said, well, you've already been an officer. You know how to do all that stuff. So we're just going to send you straight to flight school. So I'm just kind of showing up out of the blue and these guys don't know who I am. Like, here's my orders. I'm supposed to go to flight school. And so, yeah, it's weird.
And learning to fly then, Brian, you know, you mentioned a few things, which we probably all did in our past, you know, pleasure flights and that sort of thing.
Sure.
How were you introduced to flight? How did that process work?
So when I went through, again, we're talking 2003 timeframe, I want to say you flew within the first 2 weeks of starting flight school. So the first 2 weeks was just aeromedical, you know, understanding physiological effects that flying is going to have on your body, you know, turning off all the lights in the room and seeing how your eyes gravitate towards the single light that they turn on and, you know, all that kind of good stuff. And then you go out to the flight line and they pair you up. So you'll have what we call a stick buddy. So it'll be like, you know, two students are stuck together and that's your partner. And then they'll assign a pair to a instructor pilot, you know, and at the time these were all, you know, Vietnam vets and, you know, thousands upon thousands of hours and had seen it all, you know, especially being instructor pilots at flight school. And so our first flight, you know, basically they just kind of stuck us in the aircraft and they flew around and I think they let us, you know, kind of wiggle the sticks a little bit. And then, I think it was probably the third flight is when they said, okay, we're going to do auto rotations today. And I just remember being absolutely terrified and, you know, almost, you know, just kind of crying out like, wait a minute, we don't even know how to land yet. and the guy said, well, no, it's easier than landing. And I didn't, understand
Brian,
that.
I'm missing something. Was this straight into a helicopter?
Yeah. These were in, right. We never flew fixed wing. Nope. This was in Bell 206s essentially,
wow.
TH-67s. Yeah.
That's an interesting aircraft to learn to fly in.
Yeah. It's a little wobbly. You know, you learn how to, we call stirring the soup. You're just kind of moving the cyclic around. But yeah, and you know, finding the hover button is the hard thing that all the students go through is, you know, you can fly once the aircraft gets going, it's easy to, it flies like a regular airplane for the most part, but trying to hover is a completely different animal and it definitely takes some time to figure it out.
Wow. Was there a big washout rate of people who just couldn't, you know, get it of, you know, the standard thing of people sort of, you know, rub your tum and rub your head at the same time?
I wish I could say yes, because there's probably a few guys that maybe probably shouldn't have got through, or, you know, I guess they got a little bit extra love further down the line, but no. And I think probably some of that weeding out just happens prior, right? Because you are taking that aptitude test. So I think that everyone that goes there, they do have the mind for it. There were certainly some guys that didn't have the physical chops to actually do it. You know, they just couldn't translate it. And there were a couple guys that didn't make it through, but I remember one guy, I think he quit because he just, after a few flights, cause he just would get airsick all the time. You know, there's no aptitude test that's going to tell you you're going to get airsick, but yeah, generally speaking, it wasn't a huge, I would say, a washout rate.
And how long was the training program, Brian, before you moved into a frontline role?
Sure. Flight school itself for me was just over a year. I want to say it was like a year and 2 weeks. And that depends on the airframe that you fly. So at the time, you know, going through the OH-58 Delta course was the second longest. I think the Apaches were longer by about 2 or 3 weeks, if I remember correctly. But then the Blackhawks and Chinooks had much less time learning because they just don't have as many systems, right? I mean, it's just, okay, learn how to fly and learn how to land. Not to disparage them, but they're not worrying about sensors. They're not worrying about weapon systems and all those things, which took up a predominant amount of time for the Apache and for Kiowas. So for those guys, I think it was, you know, probably seven or eight months, I guess, from the beginning to end. The hard part with flight school is sometimes there's what we call bubbles. So if the training pipeline for the Apaches, is getting backlogged and you get identified as an Apache guy, You know, I've heard of guys being on a 4 or 5 month bubble, you know, from the time they finish their instrument training to now they're supposed to move into their advanced aircraft, but they've got to wait a few months before they can get into it. So, but yeah, for me, it was just over a year.
Hi, it's Dave Homewood here from the Wings Over New Zealand show. New Zealand's a very aviation-minded country, and we have a diverse range of stories out there to tell. The Wings Over New Zealand show brings you all sorts of stories, such as interviews with pilots or ground crew, World War II veterans, post-war Air Force personnel, air show stories, historians, authors, warbird restorers, airline stories, recreational flyers and home builders, agricultural aviation such as top dressing, and a lot more. We've got an extensive archive that you can go back to and listen to all of the shows, and there are new shows coming out all the time. The Wings Over New Zealand show, bringing you New Zealand aviation stories since 2011.
Did you were you assigned Kiowa Warrior or you know H-58 or did you choose it? Were you given a choice of Black Hawk or Apache or you know do you want to come fly Chinook?
Yeah, so I chose it. It didn't choose me. you know, not all can say the same. So the way it works is you have what's called an Order of Merit list or OML, and that's based completely off of your academics and your PT test and just all kinds of things that they basically score you as you're going through flight school. So when you go through, and it's changed a little bit since I went through, but when you go through primary and instruments, they take all those grades and then they create the OML. And so for us, they basically just brought my class into a room and they said, okay, we're going to go down the OML. These are the slots that we have available. And I think for us, we had, I think like 6 Kiowa, 6 Blackhawk, a couple of Chinook, and I know we had 1 Apache. And they said, okay, here's the OML. And I think I was number 2 or 3 on OML. I think probably number 3. And I knew right then, I was like, well, I can get whatever I want for the most part. Cause the first 2 guys wanted Blackhawks. I think from the very get go, they were Blackhawk guys. And so you just went down the list. And so, and I remember there was 1 Apache slot because a buddy of mine, Bo, got that slot. He was dead last on the OML. He didn't want Apaches. So naturally, nobody else wanted Apaches either, and he got stuck with it. And it was just funny because he had worked on Apaches. He'd been an alpha model, I think avionics guy or something. Wow. But they were, you know, at this time now he had Delta models, and he had worked a little bit around them. And he was like, I don't want to fly that thing. I want to fly the alpha model. But I ended up working a what we call a drug deal with another class where they had a guy who wanted to fly Blackhawks, but he had Kyle. Like it was this weird 3-way swap. And I worked a deal with the class behind us, and we got my buddy into the Kiowas, and we actually ended up at the same unit together after that. So it was kind of interesting.
What drew you to the kind of arms scout mission though? You know, this is a, because I think a lot of people non helicopter pilots or maybe if you look at a Kiowa Warrior, you look at it and go, oh, hang on, that's a that's a jet ranger painted green with a funny mast on the top, you know?
Yeah, it's a traffic copter with guns, right? too light to fight and too slow to run is what I've also heard. The mission, right? So, and you'll hear that a lot in flight school, at least in the Army flight school, is don't pick the aircraft, pick the mission.
Right.
You know, and coming from tanks, I was really torn. I did want to, in fact, when I started flight school, I wanted to fly Apaches, but kind of go back to my sitting height story. I was told very early on in flight school that I couldn't fly Kiowas if I wanted to, because they had a sitting height limitation of 95 centimeters. And so I was like, well, then I can't, I just flat out can't fly that. And so I was like, well, then I'm going to fly Apaches. That's all there is to it. But going back to what I had done as a tank guy, yes, I was in a tank, but I was doing a cavalry role, and that was reconnaissance and security, which a lot of people equate to being sneaky and, you know, wearing face paint. It's not. It's fighting for information. It's, you know, holding back the enemy. It's all this, you know, pretty hardcore stuff. But I wanted that mission, and Apaches did it too, but the Kiowa, that was their bread and butter. That's the part of the organizations that they were a part of. So when it came time to select aircraft, I did one more check, and I asked those people that run the flight school, and I was like, hey, are we sure that it's a 95 centimeter sitting height? And they called out to the training area where they do the Kiowas, and those guys told them, said, no, that's the old, what we call Alpha Chuck model, which is a different, very different animal. But yeah, he could fly that if he wants, that's fine. So that's when I kind of changed my mind and said, okay, yeah, that's the mission that I want to fly, which means that's the airframe I want to fly.
Fantastic.
Yeah. Brian, tell us then about the Kiowa, and it's the D model that
yep.
you predominantly flew, wasn't it?
Yeah, the Delta Kiowa Warrior. So the Kiowa's got a pretty rich history, you know, dates all the way back to Vietnam is where you started to get the Alpha model, which is essentially like you said earlier, a Bell 206 painted green. You know, it was just a observation aircraft. I think they had a where they could put like a minigun on it, but it wasn't, you know, it was more like just for self-defense. You know, it wasn't like a meant to be an attack aircraft, if you will. And then when you get into the 80s, the artillery branch, you know, looking at the fold a gap type scenario, they wanted some sort of platform that could go forward, get accurate targeting data, send it back to the gun line and enable them to shoot. And so that's where the Delta model Kiowa came from, which is where they took essentially a Bell 407 and put this mass mounted sight, this little periscope looking thing on top. And it had a thermal imaging system, laser, you know, rangefinder designator, and a daytime TV camera. So, but it wasn't armed. Again, it was just a slick aircraft with this sight on top. So then you fast forward to late 80s and you've got Iranian gunboats and other drama going on in the Persian Gulf. And so this idea, and I really don't know the intricate details. I'm trying to get it, understand this whole time period, but they came up with this idea of like, well, you know, we had these 160th aircraft, you know, the Special Operations Regiment was out there doing stuff with little birds, but you know, that's a national asset. There's not that many little birds, so they don't want them tied up doing this stuff. So what can we replace them with? Well, what if we take these Kiowas and we put some guns on them? So that's how they kind of weaponized the Kiowa and created the Kiowa Warrior, which is what people, if you know anything about Kiowas, that's what you know what it looks like. So it's got the ball on top and it's got the two weapons pylons sticking off either side. And that's where the Kiowa Warrior was born, and just kind of continued on until we got rid of it in, I want to say, 2016.
Okay, and what's it like to fly? What's its characteristics like in terms of its flight envelope and its performance?
Yeah, it's sporty. You know, it's not fast, but as I tell people, you know, speed is relative. If you're going 100 knots, that doesn't sound fast when you talk to an F-16 guy. When you tell them, well, I'm going 100 knots and I'm dodging the tops of trees, that becomes a lot faster. It's very maneuverable. A lot of fun to fly, stable, but at the same time you were working the entire time. I mean, you were using the pedals, you were using the cyclic, you were using the collective throughout the flight. And so it was a bit of a workload, and you would fly some pretty long hours deployed. I mean, we were easily pulling, you know, 6 hour days, sometimes 8 hour days, depending. But a lot of fun, very maneuverable, hot and cold, because it really didn't have any sort of environmental conditioning system. It had this really crummy heater that just kind of blew hot air out by your ankles, you know, so he would kind of, if you were cold, you'd kind of take turns, you know, giving the other guy the controls and stick your hand down there and try to warm him up. But it had no air conditioning, so you know, you'd fly higher to get cooled off. Didn't have a lot of ammo, but was a lot of fun to shoot. You know, you could carry rockets, 50 cal, or you could carry some Hellfire laser guided missiles. But yeah, it was just sporty, I guess is the best way to describe it.
Right. Okay. And let's talk then about flying it in service. You did three operational tours, didn't you? The first one back in, was it 2005,
2006? 2006. Should have went 2006 to 2007, but I got shot right there at the end of 2006. And then I went back to Afghanistan in 9-10. So those were both as Kiowa guys. And then I did another short tour in 2018 as an Apache guy. The 58, it's interesting because the 58 and the 64, they're doing things that they're not, you know, when they were designed, this wasn't the fight that they were meant to fight. Again, going back to that whole fold a gap scenario, you know, as a NATO ally, you know, you're expecting the Russian horde, you know, to be charging across, and you're just throwing stuff at it. So if, as you look at the Kiowa, that's really what the concept was, of this aircraft that could hide behind stuff, hence the mass mounted sight. It could look over trees, look over hills, buildings, whatever, spot targets, send that information back to the Apache, send it back to the artillery, and then they could shoot. You know, the way Hellfires work is Apache could be sitting behind you a kilometer, carrying 16 of those things, and he doesn't even have to unmask. He can just throw that thing up in the air, and it'll pick up your laser spot, and it'll hit whatever you're shooting at. So none of these aircraft have to expose themselves to danger. You're just sitting back there, and you're just plinking tanks with lasers. Now you go into this, you know, counterinsurgency, the coin operation. The aircraft, you can't fight like that. You know, there's nowhere to hide. You're in the desert. You don't really know where the enemy is because they're everywhere. So you're just kind of flying around. So it was a very different experience. And that's where that speed and maneuverability came into play. And, you know, you'd be zipping around low or, you know, depending on the situation, you might go up high. But it was a very different environment than what those aircraft were used to.
Right. Are you able to tell us about the casual way I got shot?
Christmas Day, 2006.
I've seen sort of footage of scout helicopters flying, and it just looks absolutely insane. You know, you've got carbines, smoke grenades on the dash, and you're literally flying below, you know, the level of telephone poles and stuff like that. I mean, it's just bonkers.
It's insane the way that we sometimes have to fly. You know, I remember dodging, you know, people's TV antennas in Missoula, and, you know, you definitely had to be on the lookout for telephone poles and things of that nature. But I mean, that particular day, I mean, talk about just bad luck and timing. There was zero reason to suspect that there was enemy at this place. It was Christmas Day. We were flying around. We were told just go out for an hour and just fly around, which, you know, we kind of didn't like that plan. But you know, you're in the Army, sometimes you just got to do what the bosses tell you. So we take off and we go do this, and we're about 30 minutes into it, and we fly apparently right over some dudes who had been set up with a variety of weapons. And we were really close to it. I mean, normally when you got shot at, you might hear it and it might sound like a pop, pop, pop. This was like being on the range with them. I mean, it was just loud and noisy and smelly. Like, I remember smelling, you know, I don't know if it was just my mind, but I could smell gunpowder. But we flew right over these guys, and the way that the fire hit
over the sound of the helicopter.
Oh yeah.
The engine and the blades and everything. You could still hear them.
That's how I knew it was bad. Cause I could hear it like loud. And I could tell what side of the aircraft it came from. And then of course I got hit on the right side, and I was sitting in the left seat. So instantaneously the aircraft, you know, we get hit, I get hit immediately. You can hear the sound. The aircraft pitches over, and we're already pretty low. So it pitches over and starts diving. I'm assuming that my right seater is dead, and he's the guy that's actually flying the aircraft at the time. My instantaneous thought is, okay, he's dead. I've got to grab the controls, which luckily my arm was working at the time. It stopped working here pretty soon. But I reach for the controls. I quickly realize that he's still flying. He's just basically diving and nosing it over to pick up speed to get us away from the danger. He did not get hit. I think he got a tiny scratch on his wrist. And then we're pulling away and we're trying to call our wingman. Well, we didn't know as one of the bullets had severed the line that we were using for that particular radio, because we had four radios, but we were using one of those to talk to the wingman. He's not answering. We're assuming that he's been shot down. So now we're turning around to look for him. He's back behind us, and he calls us on a different radio, and he's like, "Hey, we just got shot at." And we're like, "Yeah, no kidding." So we make it back to the airfield. We were all working in Mosul, which is, you know, a big city up north Iraq, and we weren't far from the airfield, so we flew back there, I left Iraq on Christmas Day 2006. I didn't go back to till 2018. Flew right over Mosul too, so I got to fly around Mosul in an Apache and kind of pick out the old neighborhoods and show guys like, "Oh, I got shot over there a couple of years ago."
Going back to that, Brian, the shot actually came through the bottom of the aircraft, didn't it? And came up through some of the avionics.
Well, we had a lot of shots. So 13 to 15 rounds, depending on how you count the holes, hit the aircraft, all in the forward fuselage. And I point that out because a lot of times when aircraft came back with bullet holes, they were usually in the tail, because guys just don't lead the aircraft enough. Because if you ever look at an airplane in the air, it looks like it's going slow. And it's like, well, no, it's actually going very fast. So a lot of times guys wouldn't lead it enough. But because, again, we were so close, you couldn't miss. Yeah. So all these bullets are just hitting, you know, the chin bubble was blown out by my feet. There was a hole in my windshield. But yeah, the one that hit me looks like it went under the right seater's seat. So and when it popped out of it, actually came out of his seat right next to his thigh. It went through the collective, right through the throttle grip, which normally the guy in the right seat has his hand right there. So it's luckily that he was not putting his hand right there at that moment, or would have blown his hand off or something. But when it went through the collective, then it split into like multiple pieces essentially. And so I tell people I have multiple gunshot wounds, even though it was only one bullet, but I've got several holes in me.
And what, yeah. What damage was there to your arm, Brian?
Ultimately none. I say that in retrospect, you know, like my arm is fully functioning, but at the time the steel core of the bullet went through my upper arm. So I have two perfect holes in my upper arm, which is really weird. I took some shrapnel in the elbow, and then another piece kind of, I guess you could say, blew out the top of my forearm. So, you know, I laugh when I watch movies and guys get shot in the arm and they just kind of keep going. Not if you get, maybe like winged or something, you know, just kind of scratched and sure. But when it goes through your arm, your arm stops working. Like your capillary seize up, you know, and like my arm just instinctively curled up, you know, up to my chest, and I couldn't do anything with it. It felt incredibly cold, you know, and I was terrified. I was like, well, I'm going to lose my arm. Like, that was the very first question I asked the doctor when I got taken to the hospital. I was like, am I going to lose my arm? You know, and he's like, oh no, you're going to be fine. And I don't know if he knew that, you know, at the time, or if he was just telling me that to make me feel better. But that was my big fear. But yeah, overall it took several months of recuperation, but yeah, it works fine now.
Wow. Well, I'm glad. Yeah. Glad you're still with us after someone unloading a full magazine into your cockpit, Brian.
Yeah.
One of my later questions was going to be, what's the scariest moment in helicopters? But I think that might, unless there's any, chance that beats that.
No, I think I mean that was probably hands down the scariest. You know, I've had a few, like everyone who's flown helicopters, everyone has got at least one, you know, oh crap moment. And I've had a few where we've, you know, lost hydraulics, or you get a kind of weird vibration or weird something or other happen. But yeah, that was definitely the winner.
And didn't you have an incident where you lost hydraulics on your second, was it your second or third tour?
Yeah, well, I lost hydraulics twice on that tour. The first one was kind of funny. We shut down Kandahar Airfield, which is like, kind of like saying we shut down Atlanta Airfield, you know what I mean? Like, it's this huge base. You know, the runway was like 2 miles long or something, you know, some crazy number. And here's this tiny little Kiowa that's shut it down. And so we come blazing in, and when you lose hydraulics in a Kiowa, or really any helicopter, you know, you can't hover, because you don't have control of the aircraft. So for the Kiowa, we would have to do what we call a run on landing. So you'd land on the skids and kind of slide down the runway a little bit. So we come sliding down the runway, and the tower calls us. We, you know, we call them like, okay, tower, we're safe. And they're like, okay, can you side slip to the sod? And we're like, no, like, we can't pick this up or we're going to crash. Well, what we didn't know is there was two Harriers and a C-5, I think, that were overhead, and they were trying to land. And, so this Air Force guy rushes out, and he's like, hey, you need to clear the runway. And we're like, well, we're trying. So they brought this little trailer out, and they're trying to hook the aircraft up to the trailer and drag it off. And so we're hustling, and he comes back out again. He's like, okay, they're diverting the C-5, but the Harriers are coming in, cover your ears. So to put this in a little bit of context, I think it was an RAF, Harrier had just crashed at Kandahar. This was 2009. He had hit the ground a little bit harder than I think he intended and ended up ejecting. And there was, you know, ball of fire that blew out this Harrier. We were right next to this Harrier. It was probably a week or two prior, I think. And so we're sitting there, there's this, you know, burnt out Harrier right next to us. And now they're telling us that two Harriers are going to land past us. And they were going to shoot their approach and land just beyond us. And so, and those things are loud if you've ever been around a Harrier. And so they shoot their approach and land right just past this on the runway, and we're all covering our ears at the same time saying, please don't crash, please don't crash. So there was that one. Then there was the other one that we lost hydraulics, and we had to land on a UAV strip because the alternative was a dirt runway, which, again, go back to grinding skids into the ground. you know, we really didn't know how that was going to work on a dirt runway. So we landed on a UAV strip that had arrestor cables, kind of like a carrier. And we had to dodge those cables, but it was nighttime and we were under night vision goggles. And I couldn't really see them, but I kind of knew where they were. So I just shot my approach past it and just kind of prayed that I wasn't going to catch them.
That would have been the first, wouldn't it? Catching a free wire in a, yeah. H-58D.
Yeah, it probably wouldn't have gone well.
Are you fascinated by aviation and its history? Are you hungry to expand your knowledge? Then you're ready for The Aviation Historian. A compact format quarterly journal, The Aviation Historian is a cross between a magazine and a book. It uses the best authors and the best picture sources to explore the less well-known paths of the history of flying. It's created by experienced, award-winning former Aeroplane magazine editors Mick Oakey, that's me, and Nick Stroud, so you can trust it for quality, accuracy, and sheer passion for the subject. The Aviation Historian. We're print, we're digital, but we're not in the shops. Order us online and find out more at theaviationhistorian.com. Are you ready for it?
Let's talk about the AH-64. How did that come about?
Yeah, so I left flying Kiowas and I was in a non-flying job. I was teaching. And around that time is when the Army made the financial decision to divest the 58 and kind of reshuffle money around and things. And, you know, it's kind of like musical chairs when any military gets rid of aircraft. Because I've talked to guys in the Air Force, you know, when the MH-53 went away, it was the same thing. There's only so many chairs left for people when the music stops. So I was lucky enough to get one of those chairs, and they said they were going to send me off to the Apache Corps. So I finished all the assignments that I was in and went down to Fort Rucker and went through about 5 months of aircraft qualification in the 64 Delta, and then went to my first unit at Fort Hood, where they were just getting fielded the Echo model, which, you know, is an Apache, but it's different enough that it's like a whole new airframe. Like, it's listed differently in your records and things of that nature. There's some differences to the limitations and emergency procedures, and of course the systems are vastly different in some ways. But so I got a little bit of Delta time, but most of my time was in the Echo.
How steep was the learning curve in kind of transitioning to the Apache? Because I mean, reading Ed Macy's book, you know, he was saying that people were, you know, people were washing out from the course who were kind of display pilots, experienced instructors. Some people just couldn't get the, you know, the switchology, the fact you've got so many controls, the fact it's digital. Yeah. You know, you've got the helmet-minded sight with the, you know, independent moving eyes.
Yeah. Well, I don't think it was that hard. It was kind of weird because when I went through, there was two other Kiowa guys and they were both like me. You know, they were both had been doing this for a while. You know, we all had around 2,000 hours already. So you're just going to a different aircraft. And the 58 was a digital aircraft as well. In fact, it was the first glass cockpit aircraft that the Army had. So none of that was intimidating. We were actually a part of a foreign class. So, you know, we'll have other nations send their pilots through our course. So we had, I want to say, 11 Saudi Arabian lieutenants who hadn't flown an aircraft in 2 years because they went through basic flight training down in Australia. And then they had a 2-year bubble before they got to go to the Apache course. So they had 11 of those kids and then three of us who had already deployed multiple times. There was definitely a disparity of our abilities from theirs, and rightly so. You know, they didn't know, you know, up from down when it came to the helicopters like we did. And so our class eventually kind of split off. Like, they took the three Americans and they're like, okay, you guys are well beyond those dudes. We can't afford to keep you stuck with them. So we're going to kind of give you your own IPs and let you do your own thing. But as far as like washing out, I'm sure some do, but at least for us, I think our military does a really good job of being able to break stuff down and we've got the time and money that we can spend to give people extra hours to make sure that they get where they're going. For the Apache, it yes and no, it's hard, but I think it's more intimidating to look at. And then once you get into it and you start figuring stuff out, you're like, okay, this isn't that hard. You know, the eye thing, I think people misread or misunderstand sometimes what that actually means. It's not that, you know, you're looking to the left and your other eye is looking to the right. Like, that's not how it works. That sensor moves with your head.
Yeah.
So it is a different perspective of your eyeball, but it's still looking at the same thing. And it's most prevalent when you turn your head like 90 degrees, because now if you look to the left, your right eye is, you know, 10 feet to your right, to the right side of your head. So it gives you a different perspective as if your head is much wider than it is. But when you're looking like straight ahead, it's really not a big deal. When you're looking to the right, then it's kind of weird because your right eye is left of your left, but you don't notice these things as much. And it takes a little bit to get used to. But again, they do some interesting torture to you to get used to it, particularly the bag. So if anyone's ever watched Firebirds, they are familiar with the concept of the bag, which is, you know, they put you in a perfectly good aircraft that has every window taped shut. And it is pitch black inside your cockpit. The front seater is fine. Instructor pilot, he can see for days. But you are stuck in the bag. And the only way you can see out of the aircraft is through that night vision sensor. And you go fly around, and the first day is terrible. Like, you feel like you're just going to hurl. And the second day, it's better. And the third day, it's boring, you know, so.
Oh, well, I suppose that's one way of doing it. Just before we move off your military career, sure, and talk about some other things. You've also had some other interesting roles. You mentioned training there. What was this role with the FAA? How does that fit into your career?
Oh, so that's kind of it's actually changed since I went through. But there was when you become a senior captain, junior major, you go through what's called intermediate level education. Command and General Staff College, and they had a program at the time that was a internship interagency fellowship is what it was called. And there was probably about 40 of us that got selected for this, and this was our version of Command and General Staff. And so instead of going to Fort Leavenworth, which is where everybody went, we got sent to DC. We went through a couple months of just normal classes, what they, you know, called basic or common core classes, the tactics and stuff. And then we got farmed out to all these different agencies to work. So, you had guys go to the NSA, the CIA, FBI. And then because I was a pilot, you know, they sent me to the FAA. I hate to say it. It wasn't a very remarkable or fun job. I wasn't really doing a whole lot, particularly with aviation. I was actually working like the crisis management cell. So in case of the next Hurricane Katrina or something like that, that was kind of the section that we worked in. But yeah, there wasn't too much to talk about there, honestly.
Right. Okay. And then one final question before we go on to talk about the podcast and sure, flight sim. How does your call sign CASMO, where does that come from?
So, you know, in the Army, we don't do call signs in the traditional sense, right? So guys aren't walking around like, hey, I'm Spike, you know, and things like that, as you'll see with a lot of others. But it's like anything else, you know, you're in an organization or you're around people and you get nicknames and things like that. So it's really a derivative of something like that. So, and my wife was listening to me. I was on a different show a while back and I got the same question, and she kind of reminded me that I'd missed a part. So when I was a fairly junior pilot, we were at some party for our unit, you know, and as aviation parties tend to be, there's a little bit of alcohol involved and stuff. And this was, you know, the early 2000s or whatever. And, you know, the Marvel movies, the X-Men movies were a big thing. And I think the conversation, as my wife reminds me, is, you know, we were joking about if people had an X-Men name, what would their name be? And I think I'd said something really sarcastic, as I'm fairly known for doing. And so they said, well, your name would be Sarcasmo. So, and my boss loved it and thought it was hilarious. And even to this day, he'll sometimes refer to me that. So I basically, you know, when I needed an online presence, if you will, I just kind of took that and shortened it a little bit, because Sarcasmo is a bit of a mouthful. So
that's quite cool, actually. That's quite cool. Thanks for that. So one of the projects that you have undertaken recently is to produce a podcast. But tell us a little bit about it, because you set off with an ambition to I used the term teach earlier, actually, to try and educate the audience bit about the use of the helicopter in air warfare.
Yeah, I think for me, it all really spurred back to being a Kiowa guy. And when you were a Kiowa pilot in the Army, you knew that you were at the bottom of the barrel when it came to, you know, a mother's love, if you will, because, you know, the Apache, all the money was going there. The Kiowa was always meant as an interim aircraft while they brought the Comanche online, right? The stealth helicopter that never was. And so the Kiowa was always the redhead stepchild, if you will. And I remember just like I was talking about the whole, you know, Iranian gunboat Operation Prime Chance, you know, you meet some of these guys who are legends in your community. And then you hear other things. Like, I knew a guy who flew in Somalia, you know, and we got to talking, and he was there during Black Hawk Down, the whole Black Hawk Down thing. And I'm like, wait a minute, there were Kiowas there? And he's like, yeah, how do I not know that? And so as a Kiowa guy, I always thought, like, man, somebody should write a book about this stuff. Like, I don't want a book about me. I want a book about the Kiowa. And I kind of eventually realized, like, well, no one's going to do that. So I guess I should do something. And so years ago, I started to reach out to people, and I floated the idea of writing this book, and I just couldn't get anyone really to buy in with me and kind of help me fill it out with stories. And so I kind of gave up on it. And then fast forward to this past year or so, and, you know, I'd never really listened to podcasts, and I came across the Fighter Pilot Podcast. And of course, you know, the fighter community has plenty of advocates, and I get it. They're sexy. You know, jets are awesome. I'd love to fly one. But it just got me to thinking. I was like, man, you know, we don't really have a voice. Like, there's not really a Fighter Pilot Podcast equivalent, if you will. Yeah. At least none that I knew of. And I kind of looked around, and I didn't really find any. So then I started my YouTube channel, and that was more on the simulation front. And then just by virtue of that, I ended up meeting some people, and one of them had some experience in a podcast, my buddy Kelly. He suggested it. He was like, you know, you should start a podcast and get some of these stories out, because people think that I have interesting stories, and they probably are to someone. To me, they're not, you know, they're just kind of boring. But I mean, I know guys who have real legitimate, like, jaw dropping stories. Yeah. And you can't find them anywhere. There's no information about it. And like I was joking, I think with C.W. Lemoyne the other day when I was on his show, it might have been with him. You know, we would sometimes read these awards, you know, like, oh, this A-10 or this F-16 or whatever got, you know, this pilot got this award for this thing that he did in combat. And we're all kind of looking at each other like, yeah, I did that last Tuesday, you know, like, and then like a week before that, I did the same thing, you know, like, you know, and I'm being somewhat tongue in cheek about it, but that's the kind of exposure that helicopters are doing a lot of wild stuff overseas, and guys don't really hear about it because it just doesn't make the news, and it's not as big of a PR event as when a jet does it. And so that's kind of my goal going into it, is to just kind of tell that story and have other people's stories told. You know, again, it's not about me. It's about telling those guys' stories. And I've been very fortunate to kind of, through my YouTube channel, to actually meet someone who worked on the Fighter Pilot Podcast, who then introduced me to Jello. Jello has since invited me in to be in this sort of partnership that they just started. And they just announced it, I think, this past Sunday, where they're kind of bringing me and some other little military aviation podcast together. And we're kind of all working together and pooling our resources and stuff. So it's been this really wild ride, and it's been awesome, because that's the fundamental goal is introduce people to things that they had no idea was going on. And it's actually pretty interesting to listen to.
Wow.
Yeah. Go on, Tim.
Well, I was going to say, a low-level hell podcast comes from, you know, one of two famous Vietnam War books about helicopters, yep. Isn't it? A low-level hell and Chicken Hawk is the other one. I mean, I think I remember reading, I mean, just again, jaw-dropping stories from low-level hell, where kind of Loach pilots landing on top of bunkers, of, you know, Viet Cong bunkers, and getting out with kind of their personal weapons. And
oh, yeah.
You know, it's just... There's a
story, again, this is the kind of stuff I want to tell because people don't know about it. You know, there was a Kiowa in Desert Storm, or right before Desert Storm kicked off, that landed and took the surrender of like 30 Iraqi soldiers on a little island. You know, it got out with his Colt 45, you know, and accepted the surrender. But you're absolutely right. And growing up as a 58 guy, you know, low level hell, the book was like the scout Bible, you know, it was just an interesting book and a lot of neat stuff. And so when I started my YouTube channel and I wanted to start this little community that I did on Discord, you know, I was like, well, I need a name for it. What am I going to name it? And that was the first thing that popped in my head. And I was like, you know what? That's I think that's perfect. And then it kind of bled over into the podcast. So yeah, that's a great book.
And you've had some fabulous guests already. But as I said, some of those early episodes are really informative as well. Yeah. So definitely recommend it. I think at the time we're talking now, you're episode 9 or so. But really recommend to folks they go over and have a listen to it, because particularly the last few guests have had fantastic stories to tell. Really, really enjoyed it. So well done on that front. Any exciting guests or stories coming up you can give us a bit of a teaser for?
Yeah, episode 10 is actually with John Waters from the Afterburn podcast, so he's gonna be my first jet guy. He's great. He's kind of become a friend of mine, podcast wise. Like, you know, we'll text each other and chat and stuff. And he had me, of course, on his show. But I wanted to make my show not just about helicopters, but really air to ground. Because again, going back to the fighters, everybody's excited about dogfights and stuff. And I'm like, yeah, but I want to hear more about bombs dropping and, you know, that kind of stuff. But John's got some experience as an F-16 guy, so we brought him on. And then episode 11 was actually one of my former pilots. He was a new guy when I was leaving the 58 community, and he was in a very intense wreck in Afghanistan that left him paralyzed. But he came onto the show and kind of told his story. So that'll be episode 11. That's coming up. And then we're about to do, I guess you could call it an international series. So through, again, my YouTube channel, I've come across guys who are UK pilots, Australian pilots. And so we're going to have them on and do a couple shows on the experience that, you know, our partners, not just the US guys, but our international partners have gone through as well.
Brilliant.
Wow.
From across the globe, from the center of aerospace, and now to you.
The Royal Aeronautical Society is the world's only professional body dedicated to the entire aerospace community. Established in 1866 to further the art, science and engineering of aeronautics, the Society has remained at the forefront of developments in aerospace. We will bring you multimedia, lectures and discussion from inside the world of aviation, aeronautics and space. If you enjoy our content, please consider showing your support for the Society. If you have an interest in aerospace, find out about the professional and personal benefits that Society membership offers. Visit www.aerosociety.com.
Finally, Brian, I can't let you go. Well, Tim can't let you go without talking about flight and, more importantly, combat flight simulation, because I think that's particularly where you're focused. So I'm probably going to gently withdraw into the dark and let Tim pick this up. But tell us about how that's fitting in this world of podcasting and post-military service.
Yeah, it all kind of stems back from that same concept for me of the exposure or lack thereof, right? So the DCS community, digital combat simulator community, is very, very into the fighter mentality, and there's a lot of subject matter experts that kind of weigh in and stuff, and there's some great stuff out there. But then I was looking around at the helicopter side, and it was the same thing. It was like, there's just no, you know, I know there's guys that play, and I know there's guys that kind of share things here and there, but you know, you can't find anyone that's kind of representing the helicopter community that actually has any experience. And by chance, I came across Polychop is creating a Kiowa module for DCS, and I happened to see that a guy I served with was working with them in the development. And so I kind of pinged him and was like, hey, you know, get me in on this. And so he did. And after spending some time on that and kind of looking around on YouTube and stuff, I said, you know, I'll just start a little channel myself and kind of do some stuff. And yeah, it's been growing pretty steadily. It's been fun. It's been less than a year, and I think I'm at like 4,500 subscribers at this point, which is, I think, pretty decent. So yeah, it's a lot of fun.
And there's likely to be a whole influx of people later on this year when the Kiowa and DCS have announced the AH-64D is coming to the platform. I mean, how excited are you by those?
Oh yeah, I mean, and don't forget the Hind, right? So anything.
Oh yeah, Hind as well. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, in fact, I think the Hind is going to be the first one up of the three. I think it's going to be a huge year. I struggle with the concept of trying to release so many so many great helicopters in the same year, you know, because even my wallet is kind of, you know, dreading it. So I'm sure there's some guys that are having some serious problems deciding. But yeah, as far as a channel standpoint, I there's nothing but growth at that point. It's going to put a lot on me because I don't learn the modules that great as much as, you know, there's kids out there who just know ins and outs of all these modules, you know, and they can tell you all these great details. I don't play it enough, and I don't know that I care enough to get to that level of detail. And so I'm intimidated when I do any kind of tutorial because I'm just waiting for this 18-year-old kid to come swooping out of nowhere and tell me that actually it's this, and he's probably right. So I try to lean more to tutorials on very simple things or just kind of a how-to from a tactic standpoint because that is my bread and butter, if you will. But yeah, when the Hind and the Kiowa and Apache hit, you know, I'm going to have to be a little bit more probably in the weeds and read the manuals and test some stuff out. And then, of course, it's the standard, you know, race against the clock. Like, you want to get it out in a timely fashion. You know, there's no point sending out a tutorial 6 months later. So, yeah, I've got to carve out some time or prepare myself.
Well, the thing that I love about your tutorials are they are kind of explaining, you know, not how to flick switches and get the thing started up, yeah. But the kind of the tactical considerations, you know, what's a realistic scenario, what you should be thinking about, you know, for the real kind of hardcore players who want to kind of, okay, well, we want to approach this from a, you know, a professional's point of view. So that really, really, you know, kind of, you know, a gold mine for anyone in DCS flying helicopters. I mean, what do you think DCS needs to add for their kind of growing rotary wing pilots? You know, and maybe in, I don't know, in terms of scenery is pretty good, but you know, in terms of objects or things like that, or mission right. design or triggers.
Yeah, the Syria map is beautiful. I think the first time I flew it, I mean, I was like, yep, this is exactly what I think of in the Middle East and my experiences. So that's good for the rotary side. You know, I think what they need, of course, is they got to fix the multi-crew because a helicopter is decidedly a multi-crew experience. Like the KA-50, my hat's off to the guys who flew that thing because that is, you're working hard. But but the Apache, it's not going to work that way. Like you're going to have something. You're going to have a pretty robust AI. Same with the Kiowa. And I know from dealing with Polychop that they've got a pretty interesting system that they're working with the AI there. So, but definitely multi-crew has got to get worked out, cause that's going to add a whole new flavor. And then I think just the enemy in general, it's funny to me that, you know, we've been in the global war on terror longer than DCS has been a thing. And yet I have to get mods in order to have, you know, enemy counter, you know, insurgents. You know, everything's focused on this sort of Cold War gone hot type scenario. And that's the other problem with DCS, just in general. I say problem, I don't mean to be offensive to them, but because they're doing some good things and putting out some good works, but it's kind of all over the place. You know, it's like, well, what is the time period that we're focused on here? Because I've got this Huey from like the 70s and I've got this F-18 from 2004. And, you know, it just kind of gets confusing and muddled. And then it's like, well, how do you match these things up and create a worthwhile scenario? So, and then I talk to guys who have flown some of these fixed wing aircraft and they're confused because, you know, it's like, well, it's this block of an aircraft, but it has this block's software, it has this block's buttons, you know, so it's kind of this hodgepodge of stuff. And I think people that play DCS and they're not real life pilots for these aircraft, I don't think they understand why, you know, the movers and the me and guys, why we crash all the time. It's because it's just a completely different feeling. You know, in fact, I was talking to a mover the other day and he was talking about dogfighting and he was saying like, well, you know, there's so many physical cues that I have in a dogfight that I can't get in DCS. Like I don't feel the G suit inflating. I don't feel the blood rushing out of my head, you know, and it's the same for me hovering. Like I don't feel, you feel the aircraft moving before your eyes register it's moving. And so there's all these things that us as real pilots, we kind of lose sight on. And so we look like buffoons, honestly, when we're flying with guys who that's their only experience because that's what they know and they're good at it. So, but yeah, that's what, to go back to your question, that's what I think they need. They need multi-crew and they need, we need to expand the enemy base.
Are you flying with VR?
I'm not. I did for a little bit. Somebody let me borrow their goggles and I tried them out. You know, the problem with being a content creator, and I can't believe that I'm a 42-year-old man saying that I'm a YouTube content creator, but it's certainly not the path that I expected to chart out. But I haven't really seen a whole lot of good VR video that I would like watching. So I tried it for a little bit, and I just felt like for me it was trading one problem for another. And so I said, you know what, I just can't justify spending the money on this right now. I think in the next couple of years, VR will be at a place where I don't feel that way with it. It was certainly interesting, and playing IL2, I don't know if you ever played any IL2, that was beautiful in VR.
It's an older game, the graphics
aren't as restrictive, but I mean, getting shot at, my wife hated it because I'd be sitting there getting shot at by a German, you know, fighter, and I'm freaking out because the tracer would go right past me, and she's like, you don't need that in your life. But but yeah, hopefully in the next couple of years, we'll get a good system that I'll be happy with.
I was just asking because obviously, for helicopters, I'm self-confessed the world's worst digital helicopter pilot, you know, and that's why I would probably best kept away from real helicopters as much as possible. But using VR, all of a sudden I was able to hover. And you know, in the Huey, it was kind of, well, how I can land here, and I can. Let's go in that hangar and hover in that, and all of a sudden, you know, because you can pick up these minute kind of movement cues and how high you are. And
I can hold formation a lot easier. Hooked right up to the tanker and a Harrier the first time, you know, which I could already kind of do, but like that time I just rolled right up and hooked right up. You're right. I mean, it certainly adds a lot of reality to it. The thing I couldn't get around, and I have a pretty decent system, but the graphics, like I'm inside the cockpit. Yep, it looks beautiful, but I'm not looking inside the cockpit. I'm looking outside at something 5 miles away. And my content is particularly air to ground. Well, if I can't pick out the targets a couple miles away on the ground, what use am I? Right. Yeah. So, and that's kind of the challenge that I'm having. And I think most people I've talked to agree that, yeah, well, I guess if you're looking for ground targets, it makes it a little bit harder. I can't have that. That's kind of my whole thing. So.
So what favorite helicopter in DCS? What do you think is the most realistic to fly?
I think the Black Shark is the most realistic in terms of it feels like a helicopter. And I have trouble saying that because it is so weird with the hold modes and everything that it has. And I know it's not for the faint of heart. You know, I flew the first time I bought it, I was still a 58 guy. And I hated it. You know, I didn't understand it. I didn't understand what was going on. And I shelved it for years and years and years. And then when I flew the Apaches, I kind of got back into DCS. I said, well, let me try this thing again. I've already bought it. So, and then I realized that, oh, okay, well, it's kind of like the Apache. And so I started, I was able to equate, you know, some of those hold modes and some of the trimmer functions to how the Apache flew. And then it made more sense. So once I got through that and knew how to fly it, now I can realize that it has the most realistic feel to it. Like it actually feels like it has momentum, like it has weight to it. You know, the Huey just stops. You know, you're just flying along and you slow down a little bit and you go from 40 knots to 0 knots right away. The Gazelle, you know, is very sporty, we'll put it that way. And Polychop has admitted that there's some things that they need to tweak up, and they are. Like, so I've flown the Kiowa module, you know, many, many times. It is a different feel. It feels pretty good. And once they get that sorted out, then they're going to kind of port some of that back over to the Gazelle. But at the same time, I've talked to real Gazelle pilots and they're like, yeah, it feels kind of like that, you know, change this on your curve, but that's how the Gazelle flies. So, you know, it's a hard thing for the module makers. Cause what do you want to do? Do you want to make it realistic or do you want to make it flyable? Because, you know, I hear some kids complain like, well, I bought this module and I can't hover. Okay. Well, I couldn't hover for like 3 weeks in flight school. You know, I mean, maybe that's realistic. Maybe you just haven't learned how to do it yet, but then is that what you want out of a game? Do you want it so realistic that I need to feel like I'm actually going through flight school, or do I want to be able to play the game that I spent $80 on? So you got to find that happy balance. And you're never going to make everyone happy. And that's, you know, I went in making my YouTube channel understanding that, like, I'm going to get downvoted for something every single time. You know, I could give out free kittens. Somebody's going to downvote my video for some odd reason. So once you realize you can't make everyone happy, you know, you just got to put out the best product you can. And I think that's what these guys are trying to do with their modules.
Well, I'm looking forward to seeing the. I'm looking forward to your Hind and your Kiowa Warrior and your Apache DCS content coming up in the future. So yeah. I think we're about running out of time. Have I got time for one more question?
Oh, yeah, Tim. I was just going to say we're slowly wrapping up, but I know you still have some real burning questions.
Okay,
to ask Brian.
I've got there's loads of questions, but I'll go. You mentioned it earlier, actually. You did actually just say it. Best if you fighter pilots have got Top Gun, all right.
Yeah.
What is the best helicopter film / TV show? Airwolf, Firebirds, Blue Thunder.
None of the above. Like, yeah, it's hard. Yeah, I mean, Firebirds is. Definitely something. I mean, I think Airwolf, you know, it's funny, we would get new pilots and you would mention Airwolf and they wouldn't know what you're talking about and you would just shame them, you know, like, what do you mean you don't know what Airwolf is? I guess probably Blue Thunder, you know, that's probably the best because it at least tried to be realistic in things, but Firebirds are just so hammy, and you know, when I as a Kiowa guy going through the Apache course, Firebirds came up all the time. I mean, all the time. Because you'd make fun of these, you know, these dye-in-the-wool Apache guys who are teaching you, and you're like, hey, when do we get the panties to put on our head, you know, and stuff like that, which, you know, they'd never heard that joke before, but they still get offended by it. But even they'll admit, like, you know, we had one instructor who was talking about when the movie came out, they went to the movie theaters, all these Apache guys, they went to the movie theaters in their flight suits to go watch this movie, and they were all proud, you know, like, oh, yeah, we're big Apache guys. They said when that movie ended, they walked out covering their faces with their hands so that people wouldn't recognize them. So not a glowing endorsement from the community, but yeah.
Have you seen a film called Deadly Encounters?
No, I've never heard of that one.
All right, well, it's on, there's a clip on YouTube. I haven't seen the full film, but there is a clip on YouTube, and it's got Larry Hagman of Dallas, Maine. Flying a Hughes 500 at through city streets. So this was 1988, early 80s, and then obviously this is all, you know, not CGI, but it's basically, you know, if you got permission or you were crazy enough or you know, to fly a loach through a city. It really incredible sort of stunt work, you know.
Well, if you ever watch the video of like the 160th guys practicing, you know, they'll do stuff in Miami, Los Angeles, stuff like that. I mean, it's incredible what you can do with those small aircraft. And heck, they'll even bring the Blackhawks into some of those streets. I've seen video of an Apache going down the streets. I think it was in Houston or somewhere in Texas. But yeah, it's you usually have a lot more space than you think you do from the cockpit. Like you'll look at stuff like, man, that's really tight, you know, and then you'll land and you're like, oh, I could land like three more aircraft in here. So things always look a little bit. You know, objects in mirror are closer than they appear type thing.
Excellent. All right. Well, yeah. I mean, if you're are we out of time, Peter?
One more.
All right. Well, I was going to just going back to the Echo Apache. So British Army has just had first two delivered. We are going to get 50 of them. Wow. Going to be in service by 2022. What have we got to look forward to? What does it do that your other Apache, you know, what the D model doesn't do? I mean, what's it like?
I struggle to say what it'll be like for, you know, your guys' stuff, because I know sometimes the import versions might be a little bit different. It'll have some different widgets or something. But I can tell you from my experience, and I had very little time in the Delta, and I remember flying the Echo for the first time, and I could not get it to slow down. Like, it just wanted to keep going fast.
Wow.
It's the same engines, but the different transmission. Like, it's a much beefier transmission. I mean, there may be some tweaking to the engine. I can't remember now, but it definitely cruised a lot faster, and the first couple times you fly it, yeah, you have a little bit harder time getting it to slow down enough to land, or it just feels like it just wants to keep going. There was definitely some additions to its technical capabilities, such as you know, linkage with UAVs. The biggest thing for us, and again, I don't know if this is going to be something that you guys have, but the Link 16.
Right.
That is it makes me angry to know that the Air Force and Navy has had this stuff forever, and we just got it recently. that is a huge game changer. Situational awareness is huge when it comes to combat aviation. Like, people get hung up on the flying. That's the easy part. I can teach anyone to fly a helicopter. It's understanding what's going on around you and translate. And this is true across the board of flying, understanding what's going on around you based solely off what you hear on the radio, and trying to figure out where people are in space and time. And then when you have something like Link 16, particularly paired up with the Apache's IHADs, so I can turn my head and see your aircraft 10 miles away because you're just a little icon that's floating there. At night, being able to see that stuff, like, it's just a huge game changer. So there's a lot of cool, yeah, it is. I mean, there's a lot of cool features in the Echo model that I just, as a Kiowa guy, I was like, man, I wish I'd have had this stuff 10 years ago.
Brilliant. Well, I mean, that is fantastic. Unless you've got any more questions, Peter?
No, I think what we want to find out, Brian, is whereabouts can we find you at the podcast, the YouTube channel, online? What links can we follow?
Yeah, so the podcast, of course, you know, you can go on Apple or Amazon, anywhere, and search for the Low Level Hell podcast. But you can also find links to everything on our website, www.thelowlevelhellpodcast.com. And I actually just updated the website over the weekend, so it has a link to my YouTube channel. So I've created a sub page for my YouTube channel, and that's got links to all my videos and releases there. And then we actually just started another page on there as well that's got a photo gallery. So the last few guests, as you mentioned, we've had some pretty colorful guests with some interesting stories. But I always ask them to send me some pictures. So we try to post those on Instagram and things. And then what I've done is created a photo gallery, and I'm still kind of updating it, but I'm going to take those pictures and put them on that photo gallery so guys can take a look at that stuff as well. But yeah, if you find us on that website, it's got links to our Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, Patreon, and then, like I said, over to the YouTube channel as well.
Well, that's it. We'd like to thank White Hearts and Peter Dixon for their contributions to the show, and to Amy for communications support. We'd also like to thank the extended family, Mick Oakey at the Aviation Historian, Simon Jakubowski at the Aviation Enthusiast Book Club, and Andy Wright at Aircrew Book Review. Our legal policy and use of our material can be found on our website. Please do ask before using anything you hear. The program is produced with a Creative Commons license. Tim, where can we find you online?
Yeah, I'm tweeting at RES Tim R, and the Royal Aeronautical Society can be found at www.aerosociety.com.
Wonderful. You can find me at Nascot Hornet on Twitter, and of course you can find us all on our Twitter feed, which is now back up, and our Facebook page. And that's it with the arrival of the music. It's goodbye from Tim Robinson.
Goodbye all, see you next time.
And it's goodbye from Brian Harris.
Thanks, guys.
And it's goodbye from me, Peter Johnson. Remember, stay tuned to this frequency, that is of course Aerospace Radio Station Extended.
Extended would like to thank its partners, Global Aviation Resource, the Royal Aeronautical Society, and XTP Media, for their support in helping to present and produce the programme.
The cockpit's very cramped, you've got leg restraints on, you're sat on a seat that's got explosives in it.
It's taken me on the trip of a lifetime in a F-18F Super Hornet.
Knowing how to recognise a stall being taught, like, visually and the basic PPL, it wouldn't bother me.
Thanks for listening to Extended. And don't forget, we want you to contact us. Get involved at aviation-extended.co.uk is the email address you need. Extended!
This is XTP Media.